Okay. Thank you, Monica. So it is August 8th, 2023. And let's see now. I'm sort of trying to manage things here. There was a question in the chat. I did teach at Benicia Sangha on Sunday. Spoke on the four great efforts. That's in the chat for those who are wondering why I just randomly said that. So it's been a, you know, it's been an interesting week. I was here, I guess, on Tuesday. So you guys heard probably me talk about Wes Nisker, and but I'm going to talk a little bit more about him before we start. This is someone who was a wonderful Dharma teacher, but many other things. Became known in the Bay Area during the 70s as a radio personality doing sort of alternative news, and then became a Dharma teacher later on, and was a satirist, really funny as hell. And I'm just going to put his website in the chat. Oh no, that's not it. Oops. I thought I copied it. Because I really recommend you, like, watch some of his videos. There, he's really funny as heck. And some of his books, one of his books was recently re-released, and with a foreword by Annie Lamott, and they also did an audiobook with Peter Coyote reading it. So I've been listening to that. It's really great. It's called The Big Bang, The Buddha, and The Baby Boom. I always have to, it takes me a little while to get that straight. I'm pretty sure that's the order it's in. The Big Bang, The Buddha, and The Baby Boom. A sort of a, you know, a generational memoir, and spiritual memoir, but sort of like for a memoir for the whole generation, for the whole baby boom generation. Anyway, fun stuff and fascinating. And yeah, I it was one of the things, you know, I was at the hospice where he died, and so I was sat beside his body. And one of the things that's sort of been coming back to me over the past week is just reflecting on someone, looking at someone who's not breathing. And I'm not sure what that means or what it does, but I guess it just reminds me that there's a difference between life and death, I guess. I don't know what, how else to put it, you know, that it's like, oh, like death is like nothing's happening, nothing's going on, you know. And to have known him and loved him, and to see that, you know, is I mean, I don't even know what to call it, but it's a, I just find it an interesting reflection, a helpful reflection, in terms of my Buddhist practice, in terms of mindfulness of breathing and awareness of death, which are all like, you know, elements of a really Buddhist reflection and Buddhist practice. So we're going to sit, and I got out the workbook, and I think we've got a nice part of the workbook to look at today, an important part, so we can get to that afterward. So let's settle into a meditation posture. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, taking your attention out of the visual world and just feeling how you're holding your body, what your posture is like, the balance and alignment of the body. If there's any particular discomfort that needs to be addressed, or if there's anything any strong sensations, just noticing that. And having a sense of ease, softening, releasing any tension in the body. So that we can almost feel ourselves being drawn to the earth by gravity. Start to feel ourselves embodied. And in that embodiment, feeling the body moving with the breath. So this is the clearest outward sign of life. If we are checking to see if someone is alive, we check to see if they are breathing. Just simple activity we take for granted. Breathing in mindfully and breathing out mindfully. Noticing then, are you feeling right now? What mood is here? What energies are you carrying with you? Are you in a pleasant mind state or an unpleasant mind state? Of neutral mind state. And breathing with whatever you are aware of. Breathing with those felt experiences. As the Buddha teaches mindful breathing, he starts with just the breath. Then he moves out to include the whole body with the breath. Now, can you feel your whole body as you're breathing? This creates a subtle challenge. The awareness holding two things, breath and body. And as we try to apply mindfulness to these simple elements of experience, the breath and body, the complicated mind tends to intervene and take our attention. This requires us to pay attention to mental activity as we gently guide the attention back to the breath, the body, each time it wanders. The moment of seeing the wandering mind is a critical one in our practice. Here we are challenged to let go of judgment, self-criticism, comparing, to simply come back. Begin again, the breath to the body, to the present moment. And you bring a spirit of kindness to your practice. Not so much striving to accomplish something, to stop thinking or attain some insight, but rather just be present with a gentle awareness. Why would we judge ourselves or get frustrated with ourselves for having thoughts or feelings. It's natural activities. Rather, we try to bring a kind of background attitude of gentleness and kindness, of love for ourselves, to the whole experience of meditation. Okay, good morning again. Couple things before I get started. I don't know if any of you folks are anywhere near, for instance, Philadelphia. I will be there at the Shambhala Center on August 19th. That's a week from this coming Saturday for a day-long retreat. It's on Sansom Street in Philadelphia. That's on my website. And also just got word that I'm, for those in the Bay Area, I am going to be able to teach a day-long retreat at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. It looks like September 30th. I'm going to do a day-long on the Anapanasati Sutta, that mindfulness of breathing teaching. So it'll be a meditation-focused day. So I'm very excited that they agreed to that. I'll get that up on my website soon, but I just heard from them this morning. So going back to my workbook, the Buddhism 12 Steps workbook, we kind of got to the end of the introduction. And so what I did was I wrote a little, some of it's kind of, it's structurally then kind of based on the one breath at a time, where I have the steps divided into three sections. Part one is surrender. But before step one, I put in a little section called For the Newcomer. So I'm going to read from the, first I'll read the part about surrender, and then I'm going to read a little bit of the For the Newcomer section. All right, part one, surrender. Steps one, two, and three are the surrender steps. They are the time when we relinquish past behaviors, viewpoints, and attachments. Not only do we stop acting on our addiction, but we start looking for an entirely new orientation in our lives, seeking not just pleasure and personal gratification, but to do what's right. We come to understand that in the longer, more mature, recovered view, we must sometimes take actions that we don't feel comfortable, that don't feel comfortable right now, but will lead to more beneficial results than the impulsive behaviors we've been caught up in. It's actually quite a bit in that one paragraph. I will say that the steps one, two, and three are not the only time when we relinquish past behaviors, viewpoints, and attachments. Certainly step seven is about that, and making amends can be about that. A lot of steps can do that. But this does, in a way, kind of sum up the whole process of recovery. It's not just giving up the addiction, but really starting a new life, a new orientation, seeking not just pleasure and personal gratification, but to do what's right. And it's fun, I use this term more mature, but we come to understand in the longer, more mature, recovered view, we must sometimes take actions that don't feel comfortable right now. And, you know, and it's funny using this term mature, which I think is quite relevant, but I also think that it can have a really judgmental tone to it. Because when you say to someone, oh, you're really acting immature, it always, you know, sounds very judgmental. And it's a way that we kind of insult people. But I also do really think that that's kind of, for me anyway, you know, like the behavior of a person in recovery is more like an adult, you know, and the behavior of an addict is more like a child, you know, selfish, self-centered, unable to deal with any adversity or difficulty, kind of having tantrums, whether, you know, literal or metaphorical, you know, binging, and all that is kind of a lack of maturity anyway. I'm just defending my stance here. I hope that resonates for people. So I'll go on for this little section for the newcomer. And I will say that I wrote this probably towards the end of the process of doing this book, because this book and really much of my writing isn't really oriented towards newcomers. And I realize that that's, a shortcoming to some degree. I won't even use that judgmental, say it's a shortcoming. It's something that somewhat defines my approach, which is that I thought when I was writing One Breath at a Time, and I've said this many times, I thought that I was writing it for people who'd been in recovery for a while, and that they had kind of hit a wall, kind of a spiritual wall in their work, and wanted to, either were struggling with God or they wanted to learn to meditate. And, so I sort of was, I thought I was speaking to this certain audience. And then, of course, shortly after the book was published, I started to realize that there were all these people who were new to recovery who were grabbing the book and looking for help. And I sort of thought, I don't know if it's right for that, because you know, there's a certain groundwork we have to lay before we can move into the, full process of recovery, not just, sobriety or getting clean, but all that's involved in that growth and that change. In any case, as I was working on this book, I thought, well, maybe I better write something for those newcomers who are going to show up, whether I invited them or not, crashing the party. All right. So for the newcomer, much of this book can be used at any stage of recovery, but I wanted to particularly address the issues of those who are at the beginning of this process. I offer these thoughts if you are either not sure that you have an addiction problem or are just getting started with your recovery. I'm not suggesting that these teachings will be enough to establish your recovery without a 12-step program, treatment center, or some other work. Nonetheless, I hope this section will help in your early recovery process. Now we have another heading that says, "Was I really that bad? Powerless over your addiction." If we are going to establish ourselves in recovery, we are going to have to fully accept the truth that we can no longer do what we've been doing, that our addictive behaviors, whether substance, drugs, alcohol, food, process, relationships, or activity, sex, gambling, work addiction, sorry, whether these... So substance-oriented, process-oriented, activity-oriented don't work. Let me go back this sentence. It works better on the page. It doesn't read that well. If we are going to establish ourselves in our recovery, we're going to have to fully accept the truth that we can no longer do what we've been doing, that our addictive behaviors, whether substance, process, activity-oriented, don't work. Okay, anyway. In 12-step work, we call this admitting our powerlessness. If you have trouble with the word powerless and feel that it somehow demeans you or implies weakness, or that you simply don't feel powerless, don't use that word. You might just say, "I can't always control my behavior," especially once you start the addictive activity. Another simple way of approaching the question of whether you need to quit or not, is to ask, is this behavior helping me? And might things be better in my life if I quit? I find a lot of people get stuck on the idea of, am I an alcoholic or am I an addict? And I don't think that's the important question. What I've come to see is whether I could be clinically diagnosed as an addict or not. As long as I was drinking and using drugs, I couldn't deal with the problems in my life. Perhaps my addiction wasn't my biggest problem, but as it was there, it was keeping me from dealing with, notice I don't say solving, my other problems. Today, I still have problems, but I can deal with them. Life is full of problems, and drinking and using just makes it harder to deal with them and often creates other problems. Well, there you go. This is actually kind of taken from the spiel that I developed at treatment centers, you know, because it's really meant to address the resistance people have and kind of try to get around it, you know, navigate around it. You know, it's so interesting. The arguments we will come up with for why we don't need to stop drinking, you know, and that's why I think it's helpful to just like, well, let's just make it a different question. Like, let's not frame it as like, you're powerless and you're not. No, let's just say, is that helping? is your life better when you drink? Okay. Sure. You have some pleasant, you know, little periods of time when you have the first and second drink and you're acting normal, you know, but like 3 hours later, you know, it's not getting better. The evening is not improving, you know, and then this critical idea for me that I go back to over and over, that alcohol and drugs may not have been my biggest problem, but being loaded regularly got in the way of me dealing with my problems. I was talking about this with a marijuana or a cannabis, now we say, addict the other day. About this strange impact I only really saw it clearly after I stopped using, that the passivity that comes from using cannabis, because it doesn't have, you know, obvious dangers, especially not compared to alcohol or, you know, opiates or coke or anything. It, you know, it doesn't impair you that much. You don't stumble around. You don't get sick. You know, you don't black out. But what happens, I think, is that, through its various effects, which I could talk about, but just to say, through its various effects, we are almost disempowered from growing emotionally, and that's, I think, because this is how I view it anyway. When I was high, I became less tolerant of discomfort, of any emotional discomfort. And so I would become passive. And so something like a job, which is inherently uncomfortable emotionally, became a great annoyance. You know? So being a musician was the way I solved that, you know. And in any kind of a relationship, if there's any kind of a conflict, you know, if you're high, it's like, oh man, like, don't hassle me. Like, oh God, bad vibes, you know? And so you just avoid it. And so there was no, you know, my relationships never evolved, you know, past the initial stages. And then just generally with my own emotional life, you know, I couldn't handle being with my feelings. So I'd get high and then that would shut down my feelings. In any case, all of it, I do attribute my lack of emotional growth from the age of like 14 to 35 to being high, you know. Although I didn't start getting high till, well, maybe I should say 17, but anyway, nobody cares. That, you know, it just, it's like a real, just throwing away this potential. And it's understandable. I mean, you know, talk about this a lot, about how difficult it is to feel, because a lot of what I teach now is about feeling, you know, ironically, right? Since that's what I was trying to avoid all those years. But it's you know, it's difficult. It's hard to feel. We don't want to feel. I mean, even ordinary people don't want to feel. And but addicts who probably, you know, I don't want to, you know, make us, we're like the special people that much, but perhaps we're, you know, we're a little more sensitive than the, you know, than the ordinary person. I don't know, but we're certainly not good at feeling. We certainly don't want to. And so it's understandable that we, you know, try to stay high. And then, as I say, when I teach meditation to people who are well into recovery and presumably have worked with their feelings, even then it's like, ooh, that's difficult. That's tricky. You know, and so then what I'm defining as problems, you know, as addicts, we're not, you know, being loaded kind of gets in the way of dealing with problems. Well, really, I'm talking about dealing with emotions, you know, more than I am talking about, oh, I have to, you know, get my car tuned or something. You know, it's not that kind of problem. It's the emotional stuff that's challenging. So, yeah, and I will say, you know, as I say here, today I still have problems, but I can deal with them. And yeah, a lot of what I mean by that is just today I still have feelings, you know, I still have difficult feelings. And they don't cripple my life and they don't make me go out and get loaded. And then there's like a psychic break too. I think the thing that alcohol, I think, does, and this is probably true of opiates as well, and, you know, hard drugs, speed, you know, I could only do speed for about a year, but anyway, you know, these things, these strong drugs, alcohol, you know, they're hard drugs. I think when we take them, I think of it as like I'm calling it a psychic break. Like, I don't mean like a psychotic break, but that there's kind of like a break in consciousness where wisdom or understanding or emotional or spiritual growth, these things depend upon sustained awareness over time, over years. Ultimately, but indeed over shorter periods of time as well. And when you break that sustained awareness with these really intensive drug experiences, it's kind of like you're starting up again. And this is, again, just sort of one of my like vague theories, but when I look back over my years of using and why there was this lack of emotional and spiritual development, why at 35, I kind of had the same maturity that I had at 15 or 16. This is like sort of one of the reasons, you know, I know you all remember, unfortunately, those times after a binge, after a blackout, you know, after, you know, really getting wasted, you know, tripping hard, you know, with, you know, acid laced with speed like they used to do, you know, and afterwards, like, you're kind of shattered, you know, and you're kind of like, I just need to like crawl out of bed and like, you know, put something into my body. And I need it. So things like wisdom and insight, just like they don't have any ground to grow in. It's just like uprooted through those experiences. So I guess I'm, you know, my theme here is sort of about emotional and spiritual growth and how sobriety is like a foundation for that, that without that, there's a constant kind of backsliding that happens. And even without, you know, even with sobriety, it's hard, right? Like it's hard, which is why we got loaded in the first place. So, you know, again, it's like, just to be kind to ourselves, you know, not to be too hard on ourselves and just keep going one step at a time, one day at a time. So I'll add one little more like meditative connection here with this idea of like sustained awareness as the foundation for spiritual, emotional, psychic development. We can see that this is directly connected with meditation because meditation deepens with the amount of time that we practice it, right? If you meditate for 5 minutes, you have a different, something different happens from if you meditate for an hour. If you go on a week-long retreat, that's very different from meditating for an hour. If you go on a month-long retreat, that's very different from meditating for one day or 1 week. So this idea of time being connected to wisdom, I think is important. You know, and if we just look at the traditional view of wisdom, wisdom was always associated with the elders, right? The elders who'd been paying attention. It's not enough just to be old. You have to also be paying attention as you're getting old. But if you pay attention as you're getting old, there's this development of you start to understand things. You know, and when you're a parent and you're trying to explain things to a child, it's that same thing. It's like you understand things that they can't see. And, you know, and they just have like an imagined version of reality where we have like these piles of experience. So yeah. And when we ask, you know, in the recovery world, the thing that kind of defines where you are in your recovery is how long you've been in recovery, right? And when you relapse, they make you start again, and it can piss you off. But nonetheless, there's a reason for that, because there's been a break in that sustained development of wisdom. So anyway, yada, yada. Good morning. Thanks, you guys. So I'll open it up. I've filled up the space enough with my own voice. So any comments or questions this morning? Any thoughts, corrections, revisions? Steve, I know you have something to say, so go ahead. I saw you laughing.
Oh, I just find it so humorous when, you know, being a food addict and being a member of the FA 12-step group, and I've been at it for so many years, that you started talking about having a break. You know, it's like, I'm a chronic breaker. It's like, I almost break every day. And if I can get through a week and not have any breaks, I see that as a big success. But, you know, I find just a lot of mental reasoning going on behind that, being an addict and being just talking about the craziness that we go through. And, you know, then the concept of wisdom, you know, you're right. As you know, I'm getting older, I'm 72, and I'm thinking to myself, where's the wisdom in my unconscious desire to have something to eat? And it's like, okay, well, I've got a lot of wisdom in the other addictive behaviors that I had, but I'm still trying to find that connection. And I was chuckling. It just hit home for me is that, and I find it, there is some humor in it. You know, I'm experiencing a lot of growth right now. And I attribute that to the just sitting, meditating. It's where I find peace. And God, I love my sitting. I love my meditation time. So you know, thank you for asking. I get a lot out of that talk. It was good. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. There is different, just to give you a little bit of a break here, there's definitely a difference between, you know, a food relapse, which I'm taking from you is not a full-on binge, you know, and an alcohol or drug relapse. That, you know, when we talk about breaking, psychic breaking, I don't think it's as critical. No doubt there's a beautiful kind of sense of, well, I'll just say recovery that comes when you can sustain it, sustain the work you're doing with food. I'm sure that's more pleasant for you, but I don't want you to like quite, I know you're not, I presume you're not, but just to reaffirm that not comparing that kind of a relapse with a full-blown alcohol drug relapse.
Yeah, and I'm also dealing with the fact that I went back on prescription painkillers for my bilateral sciatica. And all of a sudden, I mean, I went through a lot of remorse just making that decision to do that. And I'm finding now, boy, I got to watch this because that's already starting to kind of creep in, those addictive thoughts. Yeah. It helps me with my pain, but it's kind of scary what I'm going through right now with that whole process because, yeah, it's really easy to get back into that stuff.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that, though. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Steve. Thank you. Thanks for pitching in. Mary Helen. Hi.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for focusing on marijuana and, yeah, particularly marijuana, cannabis. I have a granddaughter who is in a wilderness recovery program, and her, she was vaping nicotine and marijuana. Mm-hmm. And I understand that can increase the concentration that you're exposed to. But I'm thinking all over again about the impact of our addictions. And we're often not dealing with that when we're talking about the fine points of Buddhism and meditation.
Yeah.
And I appreciate, I just felt very present today because I'm re-examining, as you were, the impacts of our addictive process in light of the fact that I see her going through this. So I so appreciated that this morning. Thanks.
Thank you. Other thoughts? Yeah, John, go ahead.
Well, I appreciated the idea of you talked about sustained awareness, and I have never thought about that as being relevant to my spiritual growth. You know, and I just kind of wanted to appreciate that for a minute because it, you know, I'm aware at certain times of the day, but you know, if I turn the TV on, that awareness, you know, it's relevant to a lot of activities that aren't necessarily sustaining my spiritual growth. So I just appreciate being made, you know, more conscious of it. So thanks.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, one of the times early in my recovery, but at like around 2 years, I had a really striking moment where I realized that I remembered going to sleep and going to bed and going to sleep for 2 years straight. And that was different. That there were many times that, like, going to bed was kind of vague. And then there were times when it was completely wiped out, when I was blacked out. But a lot of times it was just like, you know, I was just sort of in a fog. And that was sort of the beginning of the seeds of this idea that, oh, like, something, a certain kind of clarity, there's a different clarity that's different from, oh, I didn't drink today, from, I didn't drink or use for this many years, and that something else was developing. And things like impermanence become really, you know, you have to be aware to notice impermanence, right? And so that particularly that topic, which is so central to Buddhist teachings, but really is such an important thing to see, Buddhist or not, I just found that was another thing that, wow, through being in recovery, I really saw impermanence much more clearly. So yeah, there's some value in this, no doubt. So, well, if there's anything else I want to add here. Well, I guess, I mean, what Mary Helen said kind of brought me back to what I sort of started talking about, a lot of my orientation is not towards the newcomers, and I'm not going to change that, but I do think it's important for me to acknowledge that. And it's again one of the reasons why I have not sort of abandoned the idea that it's a good idea to go to AA if you're an alcoholic, rather than, oh, just come and sit with Kevin, because I'm not really offering a program per se. You know, I'm offering more of a general way of working with recovery, but with the kind of understanding that you already have a foundation, and although I can help people to some degree get started, it's not really, frankly, what I'm interested in, you know, which is very selfish. But there you are, and certainly, you know what I discovered early on in my teaching was that there was a real desire for this idea of, you know, working on your spiritual growth after you have a foundation recovery. You know, that it's not like there's nobody out there who wants that, obviously. I mean, you guys who have been showing up with me for years are great examples of that, of proof of that. So I'm certainly not going to abandon the idea that, you know, I'm really interested in taking us further down the path. But it is a question, now it's after 11 now, so I understand if people have to go. So no problem if you have to take off, but I just want to wrap up a little bit more. One of the, you know, this is like, whatever, it's reflecting on what I do. So it's, but one of the questions a meditation teacher has to have is how much to teach the introductory path, and how much to actually teach what it is that's the edge of our own practice at this time. And it's something that I go back and forth with. But largely, I am drawn to teaching the things that I'm really engaged with, which is why I'm kind of doing this work with the Anapanasati Sutta, the Mindfulness of Breathing Sutta. That's, you know, I've been writing on that for a couple of years. It's been my primary practice more intentionally than ever for the past couple of years. And but it's also, you know, a foundational Buddhist practice. So I don't, it's not exactly getting out ahead of the curve or anything. Well, with that, I don't know if Julie is still here, but she's always my reminder. Oh yeah, there you are, to maybe make a suggestion for ongoing practice. And, you know, so maybe reflecting on sustained awareness and what that means for you and how that's impacted you. And take that as kind of a, and it's a great, it is a great thing to remember, as John said, like in your daily life, like, am I sustaining my awareness through my day? And of course we're not, I mean, if, you know, but, you know, since we can't sustain it while we're just meditating, we certainly aren't sustaining it through the rest of the day, but we can keep coming back. We can remember repeatedly through the course of the day, oh, wait, oh, let me take a breath here. Let me be mindful of this, of those washing these dishes, of taking this walk, of starting the car, of just like, just have these moments. So I really, you know, encourage you to find those moments, whatever they are, to be mindful throughout the day. So I am planning to see you all next Tuesday from Ithaca. So until then, don't drink or use no matter what. And stay safe. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kevin. I really needed to hear that today. When will the information be on your website for the day long in Berkeley?
I mean, you know, I'm kind of slow, but in the next couple of weeks, hopefully I'll try to do it while I'm on the road. But I mean, okay. It's September 30th at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, 10 to 5.
Okay, 10 to 5. Okay. Yeah. What is it, a Saturday?
Yeah, it's a Saturday.
Ah, perfect. Okay. Yeah. All right. Have a beautiful day. Thank you. I heard some things.
Hey, Kevin, later. what was the book that you were listening to? The Big Bang, the Buddha? Oh,
yeah, The Big Bang, the Buddha, and The Baby Boom.
The Baby Boom.
Yeah.
And who's the author?
It's Wes Nisker. So let me put that in the chat.
I would love that. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. This is his website, and it's right on the front page of his website. Yeah.
Okay.
So, Kevin, I just finished Crazy Wisdom by Wes Nisker.
Oh, yeah.
Now it totally blows my mind. I'm like, yeah.
I know. It's really great. He was.
Oh, it is good. Yeah.
Really Thanks, special. Joe.
The Holy Jesters. I love that.
So. Yeah. Yeah. All right, folks.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye.